African children very seldom cry. They don't throw tantrums. They seem very contented. Their mothers hold them. They sit. You very rarely see squalling children in Africa, at least in the parts of Africa that I knew. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's something to do with mothering, the way they're mothered, the way they're held. In early infancy, African children have seemed to me very secure. I thought, well, there's a lot we can learn there.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, we hear author Paul Thoreau discussing his new book. Ghost Train to the Eastern Star is based on an unusual premise. 30 years ago, Thoreau wrote a best-selling book about traveling through parts of Africa, Asia, and Russia using only local railways. Now he's revisited that journey and chronicled how countries changed. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the biggest change Thoreau found was in himself. Paul Thoreau talked about traveling, aging, and reading last September at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., and he described the 200 people who gathered to hear him as a congregation.
Thank you very much. You inadvertently used a very interesting word to describe this lovely group of people, a congregation. I always think of readers as like early Christians. We're all huddled together, you know, in a bookstore. You know, we're the last civilized people on earth. People who read books and who talk about books. The rest of humanity is just doing the best they can. But we're like people of the book, you know, honestly. And when a reader meets another reader, they really have something to talk about. They talk about what they've read, what they're going to read. And if a reader says to you, you really should read this. This is great. This is a wonderful book. Ford Madox Ford, The Good Soldier. Have you read? No, sir, I've been meaning to read it. You should read it. Then they read it. As though they're speaking a common language. They're like the Essenes or the Gnostics or a small sect of the last people. And paper books, you know, other people, your kids be saying, hey, I've got a Kindle, I've got a little machine I can read it on. Oh, yeah, sure you can, right? So people say, you write with a pen. Yes, I write with a pen. All of you, well, many of you can actually write with, you know, a pen. And but this congregation concept is really, really interesting because when I see a group like this, I feel as if we've come together, we feel warm in our passion for books and for the written word. I think that if the travel book has value, I don't even know what it has. Maybe its value is partly autobiography, I don't know, wild generalizations or something, but snap judgments. Personal experience, sex and love, violence occasionally, revelation sometimes. But really, it's about life as it's being lived by people in other places. And when I went to Georgia wasn't in the news. A lot of journalists will tell you that they were in a particular place. They're in Bangladesh during the war, or Biafra, or in Kuwait, or they're in Iraq, or something like that. It tents a crisis situation. And they describe life in that place. And it's always, the events are exceptional. And many of you, whenever I come to this book show, I've been here a number of times, I always feel that you are the most widely traveled readers of any single bookshop audience in the world. Because, I mean, many of you have been in the Peace Corps. Many of you are diplomats or former diplomats. Many of you worked in the government. Many of you have traveled overseas. If I ask you to raise your hand, how many people have at one time or another left the United States, either on a job or just travel? Raise your hands. Okay. I rest my case. Okay. If I said that in Billings, Montana, I don't think many... Or Wasilla, Alaska. not a lot of hands would go up. So I feel that we have that in common, a common experience of travel. But my point is that reporting tends to be about the exceptional, crisis, traumatic situations, whereas a travel writer gets up in the morning, has breakfast, does the crossword puzzle, if you can find one, and then just wanders around, just grinning like a dog, wandering aimlessly, thinking, you know, what's happening here? What do people eat? How do they live? And people make suggestions, they should see this or meet my cousin or see a local site or whatever. And the traveler is merely trying to make each day matter. he or she is not necessarily going to the scene of an explosion, a great event, or a disaster, or a catastrophe, or a coup, or an earthquake. So when I was in Georgia, the thing that interested me most about Georgia was the dumpling soup that they had. Okay, you could say, well, what's that all about? But they had a peculiar kind of dumplings and dumpling soup. They had two or three kinds. Western Georgia had some, a particular type of dumpling, and Eastern Georgia another. The other was the railway ran from Batumi to Tbilisi and then on to Baku, the Trans-Caspian Railway. Pretty interesting. I mean, a result of the oil that had been in Azerbaijan. And Alfred Nobel and the Rothschilds had big consortiums there. When I went there, I wasn't going to a big event. I was merely making a big detour around Iran and Afghanistan. I went from there to Azerbaijan, to Turkmenistan. So I was seeing Georgia at a time when people were merely living their lives. And the three words that I used to describe Georgia, but I was in the hinterland of Georgia. And I said in the book, if you came into Tbilisi and saw the casinos, the opera house, the ballet theater, the synagogues and churches and the squares, you'd say, pretty interesting, pretty nice place. If you go from the hinterland, the back door, as it were, from Batumi, Makinjuri to Gori, and then to Tbilisi, you'd say peasant economy, backward-looking, Russophobic, which were the three words that came to mind. And I thought intensely Russophobic and simple peasant economy, as far as I could see, and thinking about the past. Also, as I think some people reported, and I couldn't resist noticing, there's a street in Tbilisi called George W. Bush Street. What does that tell you? I mean, maybe the only one. Well, I never saw many streets of that kind. We don't have one in Massachusetts, and they may have one in Crawford, Texas. We don't, but they had one there. So that tells you. I'm here actually because I decided to retrace my steps of the Great Railway Bazaar. Some people do it. Most travel writers don't do it. A travel writer takes a trip, and really the trip is seen as a portrait of a place. I listed some. For example, I said Thesiger didn't return to the empty quarter after 1948. Green never went to the Liberian bush or Mexico. Joseph Conrad went up the Congo River once. Eric Newby went down the Ganges once. Jonathan Raby went down the Mississippi once. Robert Byron didn't take the road to Oxiana again, and so forth. You know, Chekhov went to Sakhalin Island and then wrote a portrait of it. Cherry Garrard went to Antarctica once. In most cases, the traveler makes the trip once, writes the book, and that's it. There are a few examples of a writer going back to a place. Henry Morton Stanley went across Africa from east to west and then down the Congo River, and then a few years later, looking for Emin Pasha, he went through Africa again from west to east. And then, in fact, each trip taking a couple of years. Richard Henry Dana, you know Richard Henry Dana, 2 years before the mast, do you know that book? Did you know that about 24 years after he took that trip, he took the same trip again, and he went around the horn and went to California? Were you aware of this? Anyone? In a less well-known book, you know, he took the trip and 2 years before the mast when he was only about 21 years old. He had bad eyesight. He was and couldn't get into Harvard, so he got a job on a ship and went to California. California, San Francisco at that time was just a mission, a couple of huts, big bay, big harbor, but very few people. When he went back 24 years later, he arrived in California after the gold rush, and San Francisco was a huge, booming place. So he described two places, the first pre-gold rush, California, and then afterwards. He also went on. He was very interested in, he had met a lot of Hawaiians in the 1820s, and in the 1860s when he went back, he went to Hawaii, and he was interested in the Hawaiian language and Hawaiian culture. And he went to India and made a number of observations there. So he took the trip twice. There are very few examples of it. I think the last time I was at this bookstore, I had written or published Dark Star Safari, my trip through Africa, if I'm not mistaken. And it was in that trip that I went back to school that I had taught in Malawi, that I thought returning to a place after many years is full of revelation. It's like a high school reunion in some respects, or maybe a family reunion after many years. Everything's different. Everything has changed. But most of all, you have changed. There's a book by George Orwell called Coming Up for Air. Are you familiar with the book? It's about a man who wins a lottery prize, just a few pounds, and then goes to, he uses it to go back to his village, which is called Lower Binfield. And he goes down the Thames Valley, and he's kind of depressed about his marriage and his small child and so forth. And he thinks he'll make a sentimental journey. Well, it's a horrendous journey because the village has all changed. The book is written in 1935 or 36. War is coming. But everything's different, changed, modernized, in some respects Americanized, although he says there's a lot of fakery. And where there was a baker, there's a little tea shop, a cute little place. Where he used to go fishing, the fishing hole is full of old tires and garbage and stuff. And so Orwell was always trying to come to grips with the modern age and finding it coming up wanting. That 1984 is really about 1948, and it's about really the kind of deprivation that and post-war depression and destitution, and also totalitarianism that was always at the back of his mind. But so it's a return journey. That is, there aren't a lot of them. And with Dark Star Safari, that's a trip that really opened my eyes to so many things. That going back to Africa, first, I had never been down the Nile or to the Sudan or Ethiopia, which is pretty interesting. I had never been to the desert of northern Kenya. I realized that the desert of northern Kenya is full of roaming bands of shifter, bandits, basically just holding up cars, and they've got very skinny camels. They're having a very bad time, but they're highwaymen. Didn't know that. They're coming out of the Ogaden Desert. Then I went back to Uganda. Wasn't doing too well. People say it's doing well. You know, Bono, Clinton, they go there doing fine. They're not. You could slap every African leader on the back and say, you know, and get a state visit, and he'll show you a school that's running or a clinic. But if you work 2 years or 6 years, as I did, in Africa and learn the language and find out, it doesn't look that great. If you parachute in as a celebrity or a former president, yes, they'll show you some success stories. But you on a bus, or you as you backpackers know, it's not rosy. So I went back to my school in Malawi. Anyway, you may have read the book or not, but it wasn't doing well at all. And I thought, 30-odd years after the Peace Corps, all aid, five-year plans, hope, Oxfam, save the children, build a road, more money, AIDS research, etc. It was much worse. There were more illiterate people, poorer people, hungrier people than there were when I was there. And we had thought all those years ago, as you do when you're young, progress is straight north. As you know for the past couple of weeks, it's not. It's things happen, you know, bad things happen. So that told me that I had only seen Africa in the 1960s at a particular time, and a golden age, actually, when in the 1960s, that afterwards things were different. Not worse in every way. I pointed out in the book something that, you know, people who go to Africa quickly, they think, well, these children need to be rescued. But I was fascinated by the fact that African children very seldom cry. They don't throw tantrums. They seem very contented. Their mothers hold them. They sit. You very rarely see squalling children in Africa, at least in the parts of Africa that I knew. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's something to do with mothering. The way they're mothered, the way they're held, the way they're in early infancy, African children seem to me very secure. And I thought, well, there's a lot we can learn there. When Graham Greene went to Africa in 1935, and he went with his cousin, and he went to Sierra Leone, and then walked through the back of Liberia. He was seeing Liberia at a very crucial time in its history when Firestone had heavy investments there, still do, I think. But there were local, I won't say warlords, but there were local leaders, big sort of provincial leaders. Colonel Elwood was one in Liberia, and he met him. So Green wrote the book. If you read Journey Without Maps. You'd see it's a brilliant book, but it's a psychological travel. He's going around the back of Liberia, and it's as though he's going alone. He doesn't mention his cousin. He actually mentions him a couple of times, but not by name, just his companion. And you think, this is a bit like Heart of Darkness, a book that influenced him. He had Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy with him. And his cousin wrote a book, too, which you may or may not know. It was called Land Benighted. Land Benighted is a line in the Liberian national anthem. This is a land benighted. And I know it's a strange line for, but there you are. So Green went back to Sierra Leone, wrote The Heart of the Matter, but didn't go back to Liberia. If you read the book, you'd think, so this is Liberia. He talks about dancing in the villages and the coastal kind of corruption on the coast, the simplicity inland and so forth. Have any of you read Journey Without Maps? I mean, some of you may have. Yes, quite a few people. So, you know, does anyone know how long he took the actual travel of the book? Anyone hazard a guess? Couple of months? No, less than 3 weeks. Less than 3 weeks. Actually, 18 days. 18 days. With Stanley, it was almost 3 years, going in one direction, and totally out of touch. It's interesting. I mean, the shortness of trips is amazing. You know, how long was Kipling in Mandalay? Anyone know? Yeah, never went there. Strangely enough, and so the actual time that people spent in a place, Shiva Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul's brother, was in Africa for less than 2 months. He wrote a book called North of South. Interesting. I mean, how much could walking for 18 days is, you know, it's a hike, it's a long hike, but still not very long. It's sometimes seen to be the definitive book about Liberia. Well, obviously it can't be. And Green talked about his love of Africa. I actually think it's an excellent book, but it's not the last word. The last word can't really be written about any country or perhaps any person. Henry James said, never say you know the last word about the human heart. There's always something that you don't know or that there's something to find out. And that's true of countries as well. So it's amazing how few people, I've listed a few, Jonathan Rabin going down the Mississippi once, as though that's it. Well, he's English. You know what E.B. White says? An Englishman is not happy until he's explained America. And there are other books of that ilk. At one time, other people, even Americans, but British writers too, would write about book tours. They would come on a book tour, and the book tour then become the subject of a book. Those days are gone, actually, because book tours are much shorter. So I thought, both based on what I had read, that my favorite travel books, I'm not saying these are bad books, but they're only books that are inserted in their time. I thought, based on that, and based on what I had found out in A Dark Star Safari, the revelation of going back in time, like the high school reunion where you see where the quarterback doesn't look like the quarterback anymore, and the cheerleader certainly doesn't look like that glamorous, you know, cheerleader. Things are different. And then I'm different. I thought, well, I'll take the Great Railway Bazaar trip again and see where it gets me, because I knew that much had changed. I thought, I can approach this. So that's in that spirit I set out. Really, from the beginning, it was all new and wonderful. The first thing was, of course, there's a Channel Tunnel, so going from London to Paris is 2 hours and 40 minutes and not a whole day and half a night of traveling. And then there's no Orient Express, but I went a different route. I won't rehearse the whole trip, but at every step of the way, there was something different, something new, something had changed. And almost from the first, I noticed that I had changed, because I was calmer. I had more money. In 1973, I didn't have a credit card. The American Express had turned me down because my credit was so bad. So I had just an envelope of money. Actually, remember money, rather than just traveling around with money and, you know, can I have $5? That, and every so often, I would give a talk at an American embassy, God bless them, and they would pay me in dollars. I was a volunteer speaker. So I'd go to Calcutta, give a talk in Bangkok, give a talk, and they would give me a per diem. So that was augmented. There were different times. You may or may not recall, but there were times when blue jeans weren't freely available. And in Iran, there was a passion for blue jeans in Iran. I can't explain it, but someone can, I'm sure. But in the 1960s and 70s, along the hippie trail, hippies made money by selling odds and ends. But blue jeans was one item that was in demand. And in Mashhad, in northeastern Iran, I remember being out of money and meeting a hippie. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to get the bus to Herat, but you know, I'm a little short of funds here." He said, "You got anything to sell?" I said, "Like what?" He said, "Blue jeans." I said, "As a matter of fact, yeah." So we went to the market, and I sold them for, I think, $15, which is, you know, not bad in 1973 money. In present-day money, you know, that's quite a lot. What's the difference? Everyone has blue jeans now. So, you know, they have almost no value. I had an Omega watch. I was in Afghanistan, and I remember an Afghan saying to me, "I want your watch. Please give me your watch. I'll give you a rifle." No, I'll give you two rifles with inlay on it. No, I said, "How can I take them on the plane?" "No problem. You know, no problem. No problem." I said, "No, I can't. I can't. Take rifles, pistols, scimitars, swords for an Omega watch." Everyone's got a watch now. They've got cell phones. I mean, as a man in India told me, you know, even a rickshaw wala has a cell phone. So there were big differences. And then, of course, some countries don't change. Burma hadn't changed. On this trip, it was sadder, spectral, skeletal, tyrannical government, an oppressive, hard military, very, very cruel government, who only for reasons of control put Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest. She's been there for 14 years. Her crime was she won an election. She won an election. So then they annulled the election and put her in jail. That sort of thing could have happened in the 1970s. But here we are. You know, it was 2006 when I was there. And 2006, 2007. And she's in jail. And actually, no one had any money at all. No one had any prospects. Except the Chinese were trading, are trading with Myanmar in a very, very energetic way. That virtually everything that Myanmar needs, China supplies, except aid when there was a tsunami and the Irrawaddy River backed up. When they had a catastrophe in, I prefer to call it Burma, when they had that catastrophe, the Chinese didn't come to their help. The American Army or the American Air Force were trying to get permission to fly helicopters in to give aid. Very soon after that, there was an earthquake in China, and China had its own problems. But at the time of the Burmese catastrophe, there was no aid coming from anyone except us, and we have no diplomatic relations. We do have diplomatic relations, but we had no trade relations with Burma. Amazing. Anyway, so that was a place where nothing had changed. Vietnam was a place where everything had changed. But I was much struck by the fact that we had left nothing behind. There were really hardly any buildings worth the name that we'd left behind in Vietnam. After all our years there, they were just sort of temporary buildings. Some of you may have fought in Vietnam, some of you have visited or worked in Vietnam, but you can testify to the fact that the evidence is basically there's rampant capitalism there, I suppose. But there's no infrastructure that we left behind. Until 1994 and the embargo, really, they were left to fend for themselves. And when they were invaded by the Chinese, we really didn't do much about it. So seeing that place in 1973, it was our troops were out, just a few left, but there was no fighting. We had withdrawn, although Saigon had not fallen. But in 73, I took a train as far as I could take to Hue, in sort of the middle of the country, near the DMZ. And Hue was just a muddy, I won't say hellhole, but it really was. It was very unprepossessing. And the river, the citadel, which was very beat up, no business, a very demoralized populace, and people just running for cover on the whole. Today, Hue is a bustling city, a very beautiful city. And to see a place at war and then see it in peacetime flourishing is just absolutely amazing. And a forgiving people, a very merciful, whether this is Buddhism or practicality, just looking ahead or forgiving, I don't know. But if you drop 7 million tons of bombs on a country and 20 million gallons of defoliant that gives them cancer and ruins the trees, you don't really think that people are going to say welcome, but they do. And so in spite of the hell we rained down on them and all the the men and women of our men and women who had died there, still, it's a great place to visit. And that's sort of, that gave me hope in my travels. Ultimately, I went to Japan and then through Russia. One of the things I tried to do on the trip was to meet other writers. I've done it with other travel. There's something, seeing something through the eyes of a writer, a particular writer who lives in a country, loves the country, writes about the country, Orhan Pamuk, whom I'm sure most of you know, won the Nobel Prize last year. When I saw him, he hadn't won the Nobel Prize. He was, but he was a passionate Istanbulu, as he called himself, just an inhabitant of Istanbul, wrote a book about Istanbul. And I talked to him, and we walked around, and he showed me the city. I guess it's one of the perks of being an older writer, as I am, that I can go and I can say, here I am, you know, I'd like to meet whatever, or network and meet them. The first time I was in Sri Lanka, I expressed the desire to see Arthur C. Clarke. And I didn't write it in the book because I was turned down. I said, they said, what would you like to do here? Met a man there. I said, any ideas? I said, you know, I'd really like to meet Arthur C. Clarke. And he said, you know, who might you be to see? You know, my reputation had not preceded me there. I was just a punk, an opportunistic punk. And he said, you know, that's not going to happen. But this time, I made the call, and he was free, and I saw him. And unfortunately, he died not too long ago. Actually, I think it was last December. And so I feel lucky that I met him. I saw old friends in Singapore, some in India, some in Burma, and in Japan met Haruki Murakami, who is familiar to you, I'm sure, a wonderful writer. And he's the quintessential Tokyo writer in many respects. That he speaks English quite well, but he's written about Tokyo, and there I was in Tokyo. You know, he wrote a book called Underground, and about the sarin attack in I think was it 95, I think 95 or 96, the Onshin Rikyo cult had set off these this poison gas in the subway. So he wrote a book about it, and he took me around. He said, "What would you like to see here?" And I said, well, among other things, that I'd like to see the subway system and show, you know, the background of the book, and then take me to a noodle shop, and then, you know, I'd like to see where they make kitchenware. Japanese kitchenware is very interesting. And so we went around and we did that, and ultimately went back on the Trans-Siberian. When I went on the Trans-Siberian in 73, there were gulags up and down. I mean, there were gulags up till 1992. Notably, one outside Perm, P-E-R-M, in the Urals, quite a big gulag prison, a labor camp. And so when I just was whizzed past it. No one was allowed off the Trans-Siberian at that stop. This time, I could get off. They said, what do you want to see? I said, I'd really like to see the gulag, because it's the only gulag museum left. And the only gulag left as a museum. The others have been destroyed. So I went. It's in the snow, quite far. It was about 120 miles north of Perm, and then spent a day in the concentration camp. A footnote to that is, I said, whose idea was this? They said there was a historian there, a local man. He said it was my idea, and a group of us got together to have a permanent reminder of what life was like, a bit like Auschwitz, except that this was every bit of this prison in Perm 36. Natan Sharansky was a prisoner there. Every bit of it was as it was, as it had been. And I said, it's amazing. And he said, yeah, the last prisoner left here in 1992, but it at times were hundreds and hundreds, thousands perhaps, men making, either working through the winter, making little electrical fittings, or just suffering, just being, you know, beaten to death. And there were intellectuals, police, party members who were unreliable, just people picked up, people who had objected to the government, dissidents, or just, you know, people who had been ratted on, spied on. And I said, this is amazing. You know, it's kind of a credit to you that you have this. He said, oh, no, the government doesn't pay for this? He said, because a lot of the people responsible for the prisoners here, or for the very existence, for expanding it and so forth, are now in the government. KGB people, bureaucrats, commissars, people saying, let's make another isolation cell. You know, that guy's probably in the government. So I said, so how? What, you know, where? He said, the Ford Foundation. So the next time you're riding in a Taurus, think about that. I mean, I was impressed that a lot of the money had come from the Ford Foundation to keep this this prison as a horrific example of it. I'm making my trip sound not memory lane, but kind of gloomy. It wasn't. It was actually pretty jolly on the whole. Everything that I saw was a revelation to me, and thus the book. But the greatest change was in myself, and I think that many of you can testify to that. At a certain age, you become ghost-like. You're not so conspicuous. You travel better. You're more patient. I realize that. And people don't look at you. You're just drifting by. You're just an aging person looking. And you don't appear, in my thrift shop clothes or whatever it was, I didn't look like money on two legs. So I saw more. I was less involved in the action. I didn't stay up late. I went to bed early, but I got up earlier. And I was like the ghost on the ghost train, spectral perhaps, but eavesdropping. And I think eavesdropping, watching, observing, that's what travel is about.
Could you comment to what extent, if any, language is a barrier on this extensive traveling you've done?
Language is always a barrier, but I was lucky, I suppose. When I was in Africa, I found that in the Peace Corps, I learned Chinyanja. They call it Chichewa now, and Swahili. So I could had some sort of functioning language. And this trip, I think the places where language was a problem was Sri Lanka and Burma, because Sri Lanka had a policy of not teaching English. And English speakers are not hard to find in the world now. But in Sri Lanka, they're pretty rare. Sri Lanka had a policy, had a Sinhalese-only policy. So you can talk to a fairly educated person in Sri Lanka, and he won't really speak English at all. But an older person in Sri Lanka who had sort of gone to school before the, say, graduated from school before the mid-70s or mid to late 70s, he or she will speak English. In Burma, it's a problem. Either because of education or because of policy, English is not widely spoken or understood at all. I had a problem in Japan 34 years ago. It's not hard to find an English speaker in Japan now. So what I'm saying is that in general, English served me, or I had a translator. In Russia, I would have had a problem, but I hired a translator to take me around to the gulag. And wherever I was, I did that. So, India, as you know from if your computer's broken, or your printer's not working, or your electric drill, you call up the call center, and the person who answers not only speaks English but speaks English with an American accent.
Are there still places in the world that you haven't been to that you would like to visit?
Many, many. I've never been to Alaska. Which is in the news. Never shot a moose. Never been to Alaska. I've never been across Canada. I've never been to Greenland, Iceland. I've never been to Scandinavia. North Africa. I mean, Algeria. I avoided going to Algeria when I wrote The Pillars of Hercules. There are many, many countries I haven't been to. And as I said, it's not just a country isn't one thing. A country is a work in progress. So you could go to a country. I mean, I've been to many. I was in Albania soon after it was sort of opened up. But Albania now is different from the Albania that I saw, or the Albania I would have seen when it was run by Comrade Hoxha. Just different places. I thought Albania was one of the weirdest places I'd ever seen in my life. It's a place I would willingly go back to. just to look at. So it's not just places I haven't been. It's there are so many places I would like to return to. In other words, there's an inexhaustible source of fascination on Earth. And to describe, sometimes people say, well, tourism is the end of it. We've seen it. You could find on the internet. You know, Google it. You don't have to go there. Just Google it. Google Earth. You want to go there? Google Earth, and you can look at it. Well, that's certainly not the case. I mean, I'll give you a really simple example. Is I've been to the Bahamas. I went to Nassau many years ago. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. Honky-tonk, gambling, nice hotels. About a month ago, I went to a place called Eleuthera. Has anyone been to Eleuthera? You've been to the Bahamas. Okay. Eleuthera, I thought, was... It was so charming, and I mean, I won't say it was so old-fashioned, and set in its way, so traditional in many respects. Of course, there's a lot of investment here, there, and everywhere, but there are little islands there. There's a place called Spanish Wells, which is just one a group of people, all of whom seem to be related in some way or another. They say they're the descendants of pirates, or I don't know. So there's a place. Now where is the Bahamas? These are just little islands off around the great archipelago of the Bahamas. But where is it? It's 190 miles west of Fort Lauderdale. I mean, in other words, you could almost see it from, and yet it's this place. I won't say frozen in time because of the investment, but it struck me as and it's an amazing place, kind of unimaginable in many respects. That I hadn't realized. Well, people are still fishing. They get conch shells. They get little boats, little farms. They're growing avocados. I don't know. They're in Spanish Wells. They're going to church. They're educating their children, and also worrying about the price of gas. But it's 190 miles west of. Sorry, east, of course. West is another place. That's the Everglades. But 190 miles east of Fort Lauderdale. So, or maybe southeast. But not far. It's nearer than New York City is to where we are right now. So many places. Too many.
I see from the map in the end paper of the book that you did go into China, but not for very long, and then you went on to Japan. What can you say about China compared to your previous journey in this one?
In 1973, I don't know whether you remember, but 1973 was the last days of the Cultural Revolution. I tried to get a visa to China, and no one would listen to me. I couldn't get a visa. I didn't go to China, but my dream was to go through Vietnam, go into China, and then travel through China. I didn't realize. I mean, people didn't know how bad the Cultural Revolution was all over China until afterwards. I did finally go to China in 1980 and wrote about it. Well, the difference between China then and China now, I think, you know, it's made a quantum leap from a country where people all wore blue suits and slippers and worked in factories with 25 watt bulbs just working away, to what we see now, what you saw with the Olympics, which is a golden age has. Come to China. Maybe not over. There's still very poor parts of China and many people living below the poverty line and also neglected parts. But what I saw was so amazing. It was so modernized, so urbanized, so wonderful. I didn't want to stay. I thought, what's the point? You know, I can see urban blight and modernization anywhere. I thought it's not... I must say, in travel, cities are not destinations for me. Going to a city, I find problematical in so many ways, but mainly hard to get into, very hard to get out of, and it always seems to me a floating world of people, and that hard to ungraspable, of difficult to grasp. Whereas smaller towns. Towns, villages, the countryside, I feel as if I have a grasp. I use the example of Georgia. Go to Tbilisi and you see one Georgia. It's the it's the great city of Georgia. But that's not Georgia. Georgia is its villages and its peasant economy and just, I mean, the people in Gori, among other places, where Stalin was born. And Stalin was a choir boy. You know, when you look at Stalin's face, this man must have been a choir boy. But he was a choir boy in Gori in a seminary, too. So China is almost indescribably altered, transformed. A better question, or I mean, an equally good question, it would be: why did China transform itself in that way, and why is India still India? That in India, they started more or less on the same base, but and both of them have energetic, imaginative people. Why is India still India, the old traditional India, as well as modernized in many cases, but it's not transformed. I mean, one is that I suppose the Chinese are not sentimental. If they say if there's a temple or a wall or something, they tear it down to put up a factory or an apartment block. That doesn't happen in India. But I find India endlessly interesting, and China for reasons that may be obvious, which is modernization doesn't interest me. I look for evidence of the past, and the past hasn't been kind to China. China is it's a litany of catastrophes. So they turn their back on the past. This is not true of India. India has a rich history that people are very proud of. I'm generalizing, of course, but I look for the past in the present.
Dark Star Safari, you had a lot of the, what you called, I think, mythomaniacs, the missionaries and people who were sort of, you know, greater than themselves. I wondered if you encountered that on your trip on the Eastern Star.
Wherever you go in the world, wherever you go, you find what Henry David Thoreau describes as the person who, because there's something that they can't fix in themselves, something in their own lives that's unfixable, they go out and try to fix other people's lives. And so the person who preaches abstinence against abortion and so forth has a child who's fornicating in the back room with her boyfriend. But she or he is the person who wants to, you know, change things rather than changing something in their own household. I'm not naming any names here. But it's the person who's proselytizing. I was in Thailand with a greatest sense of veneration, piety, and sort of with a Buddhist sensibility so strong. And the other thing about Thailand is the family is everything. That children in general worship their families. They if they marry someone, the husband or the wife has to then help the family. The family is everything. And piety, you go to a temple, and I was in various temples in northern Thailand. I went to Nong Khai and to Laos, where I had been before, because there's a train up there. And I went, and I was really struck by the piety, and not sanctimony, but people, belief, flowers, bringing offerings, praying at the Buddhist temple. People kneeling. And so, what do you find? Who was I sitting next to on the bench at a railway station there? A woman from the States who said, "These people need Jesus." Well, we all do, I suppose. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she told me she was in a town just spreading the good word. Well, okay. They're everywhere. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.